Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the battle for Aleppo in Syria that the Assad regime has oddly characterized as the mother of all battles. A former member of the State Department's policy planning staff on the Middle East, Henri Barki, joins us to discuss the increasing desperation and destructiveness of the regime and the continuing disarray amongst the opposition. Then we'll examine Mitt Romney's visit to Israel, where he has met with his close friend, Prime Minister Netanyahu, and we'll meet later with Sheldon Adelson and others of his major donors for a fundraiser at the King David Hotel on Monday. The former director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum, MJ Rosenberg, joins us to discuss the differences between Obama's unshakable support for Israel and Romney's unconditional support for Israel. Then finally, Aaron David Miller joins us. He is a public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and has been a Middle East advisor to six secretaries of state. His latest book is Can America Have Another Great President? And he has an article at CNN, Will Israel Trip Help Romney? That offers an historical perspective on the relationship of past U.S. presidents with Israeli leaders. And joining us now is Henri Barki. He's a professor of international relations at La Jolla University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He has authored and co-authored and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Responses to Globalization, Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barki.
Thank you.
And what did
By the way, it's Lehigh and not Lehigh.
Oh, sorry, Lehigh. Okay. Well, it's written in the French way. What can I say?
That's right.
What did you make of the regime's newspaper banner headline that the battle for Aleppo is the mother of all battles? Hadn't they heard of how Saddam Hussein somewhat devalued that phrase?
Well, look, it's sad. I mean, first of all, the fact that they're not aware of essentially what happened to Saddam Hussein or how Saddam used that phrase and how that phrase became essentially a joke. But there are many other things in which the Assad regime reminds you of Saddam Hussein's last days, when you have basically a denial of what is going on in their own country, thinking that there is, you know, it's only a few pockets of resistance, few pockets of terrorists. You remember that the famous information minister of Saddam Hussein was basically saying Baghdad was fine when American tanks were essentially rolling behind him on television. But, you know, Syria, the regime is not about to fall yet. I mean, that's not, yes, this is a big battle in Aleppo. The insurgents are doing much better, I think, than people expected. But in the end, the firepower and the capabilities of the Syrian military are still, and the willingness to kill on the part of the Syrians is much, much higher, and it is possible that, you know, they will reoccupy parts of Aleppo that are under control of the insurgents. But on the other hand, the regime is finished. I mean, every day that goes by is another nail in Assad's coffin. A government cannot be bombing its own cities, bombing its own towns, trying to invade its own cities and have any semblance of normalcy or state power. I mean, this is a regime that is fighting for its life and is trying to decide in the process how to probably extricate the leadership and find a solution to their families, to the people close to them, to the Alawite community. It's macabre, unfortunately.
Well, in terms of asylum, the Russian foreign minister got very testy when reporters asked him about reports that the Russians had offered Assad asylum. And the Russians, of course, are pretty surly about this whole situation. I guess they see the writing on the wall, and I imagine that when Assad falls, they're not going to be particularly welcome in that country.
Well, look, we don't know where Assad is going to end up. I mean, I don't see him having many options. I mean, Iran and Russia are the only two. I don't think the Chinese will want him. So, unless he wants to go to North Korea. But the truth is, he also has to think about a place that will not give him up, let's say, 5 or 6 years later, because there will be huge numbers of lawsuits against him. There will be international criminal court proceedings. I mean, the world is going to become too small for Assad, and he needs to go to some place where he can be sure that he's not going to be extradited.
Well, he's already destroyed the city. You're talking. This is the part that's bizarre, the extent to which he's prepared to destroy his own country to save his own hide. Homs is finished, isn't it? And Aleppo could well be destroyed.
Well, look, Aleppo is a very large city, so I suspect neighborhoods will be completely destroyed. I don't think the whole city will be destroyed. Look, this is a fight on the part of Assad and the Alawites in Syria for their very survival. I mean, they don't see a way out. The other thing that we have to understand here is that Assad was never a very smart leader. I mean, Assad is not a great visionary, a great leader, or even a smart person. So I don't think he sees his way out of this. I don't think he thinks that the end may be near. I mean, he may delude himself into thinking that he will survive. And for some people around him, and for the Alawite community, it's a do or die thing, because they have polarized the situation so much that the Alawites are terrified that in the event insurgents win, there's going to be a bloodbath. And it's not an unrealistic fear. It's a fear that the Assad regime has encouraged in order to stiffen up resistance. But what we do see, and what we will see eventually, is that this government in Syria is going to start running out of ammunition, is going to start running out of some basics like gasoline, and it's going to be very hard to maintain military operations. Already, we're talking about Aleppo, but the one thing we should remember is that large swathes of the countryside are not under his control. So he's now fighting in the cities, but he has already conceded large chunks of the territory. And there's no happy ending to this, unfortunately.
Again, I'm speaking with Henri Barki. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University, and he served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East and the Eastern Mediterranean and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. And he's authored and co-authored and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. Just turning to Turkey and the Kurds, the opposition, the Syrian opposition, had a meeting in Cairo a couple of weeks ago to try and agree on strategy, etc., and I guess the post-Assad situation. But this meeting, and I spoke to one of the English language spokesperson for the local coordinating committees from Cairo at the time of the meeting. Apparently this, she didn't tell me this, but apparently in this meeting, scuffles and fistfights broke out, and the Syrian Kurdish group walked out, visibly demonstrating their opposition, opposition's disarray. What's going on with the Kurdish sect? Why did they walk out, and what's their future role in this? Because the Turkish government has warned about interference by the PKK.
Well, the situation in the north of Syria and the heavily Kurdish regions is actually quite murky. But here is the issue. For the Kurds, what they want from the main opposition groups is some kind of guarantee that they will get their national rights recognized. You have to understand that the Kurds in Syria were terribly mistreated, were kicked out of citizenship. They were not allowed, those who were kicked out of citizenship were not allowed to go to schools, avail themselves of medical facilities. This was really a very terrible situation. So what they, for the Kurds now, it's an opportunity. They set out the beginning of the insurrection, and now that that they think that they are a critical player, because when you look at the layout of the land in Syria with the Christians, the Alawites, and the Sunnis, the Kurds, because of their geographical position and also because if they can come up with a coherent and a unified position, they can be a major swing player. The Kurds are also, one thing that people don't know is that they always we always focus on northern Syria, but there are also very significant Kurdish neighborhoods in Damascus that are critical to the control of Damascus. So the Kurds can play a very, shall we say, a critical role, but they want, and this is their moment, and they want something akin to not autonomy, but certainly recognition of separate rights. They don't want Syria to be become an Arab country. They want to be recognized as that Syria is multi-ethnic, and so they're driving a hard bargain. But in the north, because the Syrian troops have pulled out, the Kurds now control large chunks of territory, including some maybe some border crossings. But the Kurds themselves are not unified. And the Kurdish leader in Iraq has been trying to unify them, because you have a major division between those who are close to the Turkish Kurdish group, the PKK, and those that are more moderate. But at the moment, those affiliated with the Turkish insurgent group, the PKK, have the upper hand, because they are the ones who are armed, they are the ones who are trained, they are the ones who have the militia. I suspect this will change with time, but what we will see a great deal of is Masoud Barzani, the president of the Kurdistan regional government in Iraq, trying to exert influence over the Syrian Kurds in order to A, not alienate the Turks, and B, come up with a coherent position in order to be able to extract concessions from the opposition in Syria. Look, this is an ongoing development, and we will hear a lot about it. Nothing is clear. The Turks, on the one hand, are anxious that pro-PKK insurgents in Syria have the upper hand, but I think they also understand that the Syrian Kurds do not have the muscle and the wherewithal to establish an autonomous and independent state in northern Iraq, and they also trust Barzani to run a lot of interference for them. It's murky, it's complicated, but we are in a period of civil war in a very critical country in the Middle East. You have a lot of foreign interests involved in here. You have lots of foreigners fighting now, including from Pakistan and Libya and Chechnya and God knows where else. Even if Assad were to leave tomorrow, this is going to be a very confusing, chaotic, unsettled, and unstable part of the world for a very, very, very long time. You know, for 40 years, the Assad regime, father and son, essentially held the Middle East hostage. And the irony is that even at the end of their reign, even if they were to leave, their long shadow will continue to have an impact on the Middle East. We're in for a very difficult period in this region. And what happens in Syria will affect Iraq, will affect Lebanon. Will force a change in Iranian policies. Nobody can tell you what's going to happen. I think anybody who knows what's going to happen is probably deluded.
And I guess you have to add to that, Henri Barkey, the uncertainty about the fate of the chemical weapons arsenal, which the Syrians recently acknowledged. Israel, of course, fears that ending up in Hezbollah's hands. And with the aggressive talk going on now with Romney's trip to Jerusalem, is pretty bizarre that at a moment where Iran appears to be losing its major ally, it would seem to be the last moment that you'd want to provoke any kind of a strike on Iran, which would have result in a massive retaliation by Hezbollah, who could rain rockets down on Israel. I don't get it.
Well, look, we are in the United States in this period called the silly season. I mean, this is our election period. You know, everything that is irrational and illogical gets hyped up and gets. Romney is trying to score points against the administration, but that doesn't mean one way or the other that the Israelis are going to hit Iran now. As you said, I mean, when you look at it from an Israeli perspective, I mean, what is happening in Syria is such a big game changer. It's going to undermine Iran's strategic position so much. Now, it may encourage the Iranians even more to go towards the bomb, because now they will find themselves so much more isolated with Assad gone. So that's another issue. But from a purely strategic perspective, Hezbollah is on the defensive. In Lebanon, people are very angry at Hezbollah for siding with Assad. They were already angry at the way Hezbollah was throwing its weight around. And once Assad falls, or Assad, whether he's already fallen for all intents and purposes, he's not going to think about Lebanon at this stage. When you think of it from this perspective, you have a very, very weakened Hezbollah. You have an Iran that is desperate to hold on to Assad, but he's going to lose that. So in many ways, the strategic picture will have changed radically in favor of Israel. So I think that is another reason why the Israelis are not going to attack. But part of the hardline talk is a semi-bluff, in the sense that the Israelis have actually, surprisingly, have played this actually not badly, in the sense that they've played the good cop, bad cop with the Americans. I mean, the Americans saying, oh, don't attack, and Israel saying, oh, we're going to attack. But that has put pressure on the international system to push the Iranians. And from that perspective, the administration has been actually very successful. I don't know if the administration would have been successful on its Iran policy in terms of pushing Iran if it wasn't for the fact that it could use the threat of Israeli intervention as a means of mobilizing international support. So, one day when this is going to be written, the history of this period is going to be written, we may actually find out that it was actually a very different history than what we think is happening at any point in time. That's my hunch, but I don't know this obviously for a fact. And Romney's visit to Israel and the bellicose statements on Iran coming out from that visit actually are part of the same pas de deux, if you want.
Kabuki, I guess.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Henri Barkey.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Henri Barkey. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He's authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Responses to Globalization, Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. We're going to take a brief station break and be back to discussing the difference between Obama's unshakable support for Israel and Romney's unconditional support for Israel. Welcome back. This is Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. And joining us now is MJ Rosenberg, who is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, focusing on foreign policy and Middle East affairs. He worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years and previously served as the Director of Policy Analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor for Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, MJ Rosenberg.
Thank you, Ian.
So Mitt Romney, of course, is in Israel as we speak, and he's delivering a major address. He has a big fundraiser tomorrow on Saturday evening. He had dinner at Netanyahu's home with his Netanyahu's wife. They are old friends going back to their days working for a Boston consulting firm when both just came out of MIT and Harvard Business School, respectively. So the bond is quite deep between these two men. And there's no secret that the relationship between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu is not the best. So what do you expect from this visit? I know what Romney's trying to do is peel off some Jewish American votes in Florida and shore up his support amongst Christian evangelicals who are suspicious of a Mormon but are very, very pro-Israel. So give us your analysis, if you will.
Well, I don't really think it's about Jewish votes because the Jewish community has, since 1928, overwhelmingly supported the Democratic nominee. I mean, the worst election that Democrats ever had was probably the McGovern election. And McGovern was, you know, by our standards, super leftist. He got 65% of the Jewish vote. Obama last time got 78%. He's now polling in the high 60s. So I don't think it's about votes. I think it's about money.
And that would be, of course, that would be on display at the breakfast on Monday morning at the King David Hotel, hosted by Sheldon Adelson, who essentially has a newspaper dedicated, a free newspaper, Israel Harum, that is dedicated to Prime Minister Netanyahu. That relationship, I think, is one worth exploring, surely.
Well, I wonder if this whole trip is really nothing more than Mitt Romney paying a house call on Sheldon Adelson. You know, Sheldon Adelson, even though he is, you know, born in America and he served in the U.S. Army, which, by the way, he says he's ashamed of and wishes he had served in the Israeli Army. But in any case, he's nominally an American, but he lives in Israel. So, and he had been for Newt Gingrich and strongly for Newt Gingrich. Now he's in the Romney camp, and I think what this whole trip really is about Romney giving homage or something, homage to Sheldon Adelson, his big donor. I don't think it's really much about. And I mean, as far as the evangelicals, they're not going to. Evangelicals aren't moved to vote one way or another by the Israel issue. They're pretty much locked into the Republican Party by virtue of issues that are more important to them, like being against gays, being, you know, being conservative on a million other issues, being, you know, being against, you know, environmentalism, you know, affirmative action, all those issues. Israel doesn't really compute for them. The other thing about evangelicals is they don't give money. This is about Sheldon Adelson and raising money from within the pro-Israel community, the Jewish part of the pro-Israel community. That's what it's about.
So I have a somewhat different theory, which I'll run by you.
Okay.
Which I guess that's my privilege, right?
It certainly is.
I think that you recall when the New York Times put out the story on how close the relationship between Netanyahu and Romney is and how far it goes back, that Israel's ambassador to the United States, Michael Oren, blasted the New York Times and said that Israel does not interfere in America's domestic political affairs, which, of course, the New York Times article didn't even say or imply.
Right.
And it was very, it was obviously, it was very sensitive about it. So the real question is, Given the close relationship between Adelson and Netanyahu, I mean, it's unassailable that Adelson's literally dedicated his life and his fortune to Netanyahu. Exactly. Isn't it conceivable that Netanyahu has, in fact, been playing a role, a strategic role in the Romney campaign, in as much as Adelson, by giving all that money to Newt Gingrich, essentially kept him in the race and split the anti-Romney vote, and thus assuring Romney's the nomination. And now he's dedicated up to $100 million for Romney. So it's not exactly showing great loyalty to his former friend, Newt Gingrich. That's my interpretation.
Actually, I think it's a pretty brilliant interpretation. I hadn't really thought about that, that Adelson's support for Gingrich might have been just designed to split the opposition to Romney so that Romney would slip in. Obviously, Romney was always a more likely nominee. Romney has demonstrated, both during this trip and running up to the trip, that he will bring back the neocons, the exact same neocons who gave us the Iraq War. You know, his top advisor on the Middle East, the guy who's accompanied him to Israel and is advancing the trip, is Dan Senor. Dan Senor was the spokesman for Paul Bremer. Remember when he was the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq? Big neocon, big right-winger. His sister runs AIPAC in Israel. I mean, he is, you could not be more of a neocon and more in hoc to the lobby. No, not in hoc to the lobby, more dedicated to the lobby than Dan Senor. The Romney administration is going to be more neocon than the Bush administration, the second Bush administration. And there'll be one major difference between the two. George W. Bush absolutely refused to allow Israel to bomb Iran. And Romney is already giving signs. Well, he said it, that whatever Israel does is fine with him. I think this administration is going to be more of a, if Romney comes in, more of a neocon administration, more owned by AIPAC than the George W. Bush administration was.
And that would mean, I suppose, a greater likelihood of war with Iran.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, he said during this trip, he said that there he doesn't really see any difference between any nuclear development by Iran and Iran building bombs. As far as he's concerned, it's all the same. So, whereas the Obama administration makes distinctions between lower grade nuclear development, 5%, whatever, it's 10%, and approaching the threshold of a nuclear bomb, Romney is saying that he adopts the Netanyahu view, which is any development that they do now is part of a nuclear program, and Israel is entitled to act. I don't think that's good enough for Israel. I think what Israel wants is that the United States will act itself. And I think that there is a very strong likelihood that that will happen if Romney becomes president.
Well, already Haaretz is reporting, the Israeli daily newspaper is reporting that there was a meeting between Obama's national security advisor, Tom Donilon, and senior Israeli officials. We know that Donilon was in Israel just last week, and that at this meeting, Donilon gave the Israeli officials a briefing on U.S.'s plans to go to war with Iran if that's the choice that's made. In other words, contingency plans. And now the Netanyahu people are denying that this meeting took place. So what do you make of that?
I think that the Obama administration is trying to have it both ways. They probably leaked this information about this meeting, and then everybody denies it. Everything Obama's been doing the last couple of weeks on Israel, including a very public sign, he had a signing of a big increase in aid for Israel, in which he, instead of just having the usual pro-AIPAC representative standing around him when he signed the bill, he had AIPAC itself. The president of AIPAC was standing behind him, just like he was a member of Congress, as Obama signed this AIPAC-drafted bill increasing aid for Israel. Everything Obama's been doing the last few weeks is to send a clear signal, I'm even more hawkish on Israel than Romney, except the Israelis don't believe it. They don't believe it for one reason, and they say it in their press. They don't think that in his heart Obama really believes it. And I share that view. The difference between Romney, who will do anything that AIPAC wants and pretty much shares their worldview, and Obama, is that Obama has to be, you know, dragged kicking and screaming to endorse that view. And I think that's why the lobby, if not the Jewish community, which will support Obama, but the lobby really wants Romney to win.
So what is the motivation of the Adelsons and the Moskovitzes, the guy out here that has a, is also in the gambling business,
right,
and the family that own Häagen-Dazs ice cream and all these big conservative donors to Republicans and to Romney? I mean, you've said that the Israelis don't trust and like Obama as much as Romney, but that's the difference between, you know, unflagging, solid American support for Israel and total devotion to Israel. I mean, the difference is not that great. It just seems to be in terms of atmospherics, you know, he hasn't visited Israel. And you remember when the Israelis insulted his own vice president, Biden, and Biden couldn't be more pro-APEC than anybody on the planet. So, you know, I just don't understand what it is that the right-wing supporters of Israel expect from an American president.
Well, actually, it's the distinction between support for Israel and support for the occupation. For the right-wingers, they kind of like assume support for Israel. They know that America will always support Israel's existence. But what they want is unequivocal support for the occupation of the West Bank, of basically of Gaza, which in my opinion is still occupied, of East Jerusalem. And that's what you get from the right wing. And you don't get that from Obama and Biden. After all, Biden came right out. Actually, both of them, Obama and Biden, both of them, you know, endorsed a settlement freeze. I mean, it's not much, but it indicates where the, you know, what they would do if they could. And the Israelis can tell the difference between a Romney who will support the occupation enthusiastically and an Obama Biden who support Israel, but may not think that the occupation is, supporting the occupation is the best way to support Israel. That's a real distinction, I think.
But being against settlements is a long-standing U.S. policy. I mean, even George W. Bush had that line, didn't he?
Yeah, it's a change under Romney, I think. If he's president, I think we'll support settlements under Romney. I mean, I think that it's, it was kind of surprising that, you know, George W. Bush was against settlements. George W. Bush was against bombing Iran. But Netanyahu was so entrenched. There is no Rabin on the horizon, no one like that. The left in Israel is totally vanquished. I think that basically the U.S. right will line up with the Israeli right, and I think U.S. policy will clearly change if Romney becomes elected president. I mean, it only takes a president to change policy. Longstanding policy is only longstanding until it's overturned. And I think Romney would overturn it. That's the point of having Sheldon Adelson there and Dan Senor and that whole gang. I wouldn't be surprised if they bring back Doug Feith. I mean, that whole gang is still there. Elliot Abrams, bring them all back.
Right.
That's who Romney supporters are in the Jewish community. And they are all dying to come back. A very significant thing that happened basically yesterday is that Dennis Ross, who was Obama's top Middle East advisor, unfortunately, and is, I mean, about as close to AIPAC as you can be. I mean, he runs AIPAC's think tank, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He announced that he is not going to be supporting Obama in this election. He worked for him for 3 years of the first term. He says he's got to stay neutral because he now works for an organization that requires that he be neutral. Well, that's not true, and it's a clear signal that these people whose only devotion, whose only concern about American politics is the limit of American support for the occupation, those people are going to be supporting Romney. The Jews as will be supporting Obama, but the people who only care about Israel, they're getting the signal, it's Romney.
Well, but that particular crowd, the conservative right-wing supporters of Israel here in the United States, I recall recently the former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was speaking to a group of right-wing conservative big donors, the Adelson people, and he really went to town on them because they booed him when he said that he thought that an Israeli attack on Iran should be the last resort. They booed him, and then he went on to say, then he got irritated with them, with the audience, and struck back and said something to the effect that, look, you know, my children and grandchildren and my whole family are in Israel, and it's okay for you people 10,000 miles away to want to go to war, but we're the ones that get hit by Hezbollah's rockets, you know. So tell us about that tension between, and what motivates these American right-wing supporters of Israel to be so hawkish, even more so than Israelis themselves?
Well, I think the American right-wingers have a form of mental illness. I really do. The idea that they, out of love for Israel, quote-unquote love for Israel, they would support policies for Israel that would lead to Hezbollah rockets landing on Haifa and Tel Aviv and other places is really sick. Ehud Olmert, Ehud Olmert, the former prime minister, really went through a transformation from being a far right winger to someone who understood that Israel can only survive in the context of peace. Not surprisingly, not long after he made that transformation, he was driven from office. I mean, that was pretty much the end of his political career. But there still are people in Israel. There are people who understand this. Look, frankly, I think if a president of the United States came out and said, I will support Israel within the 67 lines, we've got to make these compromises, you've got to make these compromises for peace, I'm going to help you do it and protect your security, I think the overwhelming majority of Israelis would support that. But I don't think that's going to be an option. Obama seems too scared to take any risks on that front at all, and Romney won't want to. So I'm fairly hopeless about the future.
Well, just in closing, MJ Rosenberg, what's happening, though, in the neighborhood is really historical in terms of the shifts that are underway, and that they could be both beneficial for Israel or they could turn into a nightmare. The fall of the Assads, which seems all but inevitable. There's a possibility in desperation that Assad may transfer his chemical arsenals to Hezbollah. And there's also a possibility that they may be captured by some of the jihadis on the Free Syrian Army side, who are pretty scary people. But I would have thought that at this moment, the last thing that the Israelis would want to do is provoke a war, particularly with Iran, when Iran is on the ropes. I just don't understand that kind of suicide pact that these right-wingers like Romney and company have, where they're just so itching to go to war with Iran.
I don't think Romney is itching to go to war with Iran. I think that Netanyahu is itching for the United States to go to war with Iran, and that Romney probably doesn't quite get how it would play out. Israel attacks Iran, Iran attacks the United States, we're at war. That's what the Israelis want. The right-wing Israelis want us to destroy the power of the Islamic Republic of Iran, not because they believe it has nuclear weapons or is on a nuclear development program, because they know that's not true, but because Iran challenges their regional hegemony. I don't think Romney understands it. I think what he thinks and what he's being told is, oh, just let Israel do the job. But the Israeli military and the intelligence community there say, we can't do the job. Only the U.S. can. And that's why the military and the intelligence community there tend to be against it. I think Romney is just playing a very short game. He thinks that he can ride the back of the tiger to get to the White House. He just doesn't understand that once he gets to the White House, the tiger in the form of Sheldon Adelson and friends could devour him. I don't think he quite gets that yet.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, MJ Rosenberg.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with MJ Rosenberg, who's a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, where he focuses on foreign policy and Middle East affairs. He worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years and previously served as the director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor of Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a veteran White House Middle East insider. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Aaron David Miller, who's a public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He is on the U.S. Advisory Council of Israel Policy Forum and has been an advisor to six secretaries of state. Under President Clinton, he served as a deputy special Middle East coordinator for Arab-Israeli negotiations. His books include The Arab States and the Palestinian Question, The PLO and the Politics of Survival, The Search for Security, Saudi Arabian Oil and American Foreign Policy, The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace, and a new book, Can America Have Another Great President? He has an article at CNN, Will Israel Trip Help Romney? Welcome to Background Briefing, Aaron David Miller.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And what is the answer to your rhetorical question? So far, the big speech that that candidate Romney is delivering hasn't finished yet, but we've had a kind of preview of what he's going to say. Obviously, compared to the trip to London, things are going better, right?
I think so. And, you know, foreign policy does not figure prominently in this campaign. And the Israel issue isn't going to be determinative. But in a close election, you don't want to alienate any potential constituency. You want to raise as much money as you can, and particularly among dissatisfied American Jews and evangelicals who are suspicious of Romney, demonstrating that he is more emotionally bonded and closer to Israel than the president is, could pick up a few votes for him.
Well, does this mean then that if Romney were to become president, given that the impasse between, as you've written in your article, Aaron David Miller at CNN, Will Israel Trip Help Romney, that the, in a sense, the tiff between Obama and Netanyahu over the settlement issues that won, Netanyahu kind of won that round, but in terms of a Romney president, would Romney change this longstanding U.S. policy on the settlements?
I think there would be less of a potential for a clash or confrontation on the settlements issue, in large part because a President Romney would not devote nearly as much time as a President Obama tried to devote in his first term toward the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Romney has already argued it is not central and has criticized the president for engaging in illusions in order to make it a central issue. So on that particular issue, there is a substantial difference between President Obama and the putative Republican nominee and presidential hopeful Mitt Romney. And yes, there would be less collision in the U.S.-Israeli relationship if Romney were to win in November.
So in terms of what's happening now, is this a kind of unification of the American right and the Israeli right? I mean, to my understanding, the Israeli left, going back, for example, to Rabin, it seems to have all but vanished.
Well, first of all, Rabin was not a member of the Israeli left. In the tradition of most Israeli prime ministers, who have done significant things on Arab-Israeli peace, he was a transformed hawk. I think this is campaign silly season, frankly. I think substantively there's almost no difference between Romney and Obama in terms of support for Israel or support for the security of Israel. I think the difference lies in different emotional capacity of each man to emotionally bond and connect with Israeli fears and Israeli concerns. That's where President Obama has demonstrated a kind of analytical detachment, some would say bloodlessness, on the issue of Israel. He doesn't emote well on any subject, with the possible exception of health care. And Romney is much more instinctive and spontaneous in his support, much more along the lines of Bill Clinton or George W. Bush. And that's not Obama's style. And I think, frankly, it's gratuitous. You know, fighting with the Israelis is an occupational hazard, certainly when it comes to peacemaking. But to fight and win and to do something that will benefit Israel, the United States, and the Arabs is one thing. To anger the Israelis without purpose or without consequence is quite another. And I think that's in part what's happened in the U.S.-Israeli relationship.
So when you say in your article at CNN, "Will Israel Trip Help Romney?" Aaron David Miller, when you talk about Bill Clinton, who wrote in his memoirs that he loved Israel's former Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin as he had rarely loved another man and was captivated by Israel's heroic struggle. That's not to say that you told me once that after Netanyahu first met with Clinton in the Oval Office, when an exasperated Clinton, after the meeting ended, turned to his aides and said, "Who is the effing superpower around here?"
That's right, he did. That's not to say that, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu, unlike many authoritative right-wingers, Shamir, Begin, Sharon, is not nearly as self-confident as they were. And as a consequence, he's less able to make the kinds of decisions that those three made, Begin over Camp David in the peace with Egypt, Shamir coming to Madrid, and even Sharon in terms of cooperating with George W. Bush and disengaging from Gaza. Benjamin Netanyahu is a very uncertain and tentative right-winger. And as a consequence of that fact, he's unable to make these kinds of decisions, which leaves him, of course, demonstrating his right-wing credentials and being very tough-minded, but without the capacity to cooperate. And I point out in the piece that the one problem that both Obama and Netanyahu have is that they haven't been able to find the kind of common enterprise that would require the kind of intimate cooperation that would build confidence and trust. Iran may yet do that, of course, if the United States or the Israelis find themselves in a military confrontation over the nuclear issue. But short of that, if Obama is reelected and Netanyahu continues, and it seems to me there's a reasonable chance that that will happen, the U.S.-Israeli relationship is not going to improve on the emotional, tonal side. So I think that we are in for a pretty rough ride in 2013. Now, if Romney should win, I think you'll see a lot of those tensions diffused. And again, in a close election, a Republican candidate, even though he's not going to capture the vast majority of the Jewish vote — Jews are not single-issue voters — Romney's views on economic and social issues are likely to offset any gains that he's likely to pick up on the Israel issue. But in a close election, states like Florida, you know, Jews are 2% of the population, but vote in very high numbers. So I think that Romney has the express objective here. It's to draw a fundamental divide and difference between his view, his bonding with Israel, and wants to appear much closer in an effort to gain some of those votes.
Again, I'm speaking with Aaron David Miller, Public Policy Fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He is on the U.S. Advisory Council of Israel Policy Forum and has been an advisor to six secretaries of state under President Clinton. He served as the Deputy Special Middle East Coordinator for Arab-Israeli Negotiations. His books include The Arab States and the Palestinian Question, The PLO and the Politics of Survival, The Search for Security, Saudi Arabian Oil and American Foreign Policy, The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace, and a new book, Can America Have Another Great President? He has an article at CNN, "Will Israel Trip Help Romney?" Now, Obviously, again, going back to this historical perspective that you've offered here on the different relationships that former presidents have had with Israel, has there been a situation there where the challenger to a sitting president who is dealing with the state of Israel and who may deal with them again for the next 4 years, in effect, his opponent is almost the best friend of the Israeli prime minister, whose biggest fundraiser and devotee, Sheldon Adelson, is over there now organizing a big breakfast on Monday at the King David Hotel. And he's made no secret of that he's prepared to spend $100 million of his own money, which is, of course, a drop in the bucket, to defeat Obama. Can a President Obama forget about his Netanyahu's closeness to his rival?
Well, I mean, I think the Prime Minister of Israel doesn't want to. I mean, he wants to hedge his bets as well. I mean, he doesn't know who's going to win. Neither do you or I. And I think the reality is that I don't think it's a deep, dark secret that if Netanyahu could close his eyes and make a wish, it would be that Romney would become the president. And yet, the U.S.-Israel relationship, frankly, is too big to fail. And I suspect, and there have been many tensions over the years, and it's only grown more closer on an institutional level in terms of security, cooperation, intelligence sharing. I think the U.S.-Israel relationship is going to survive. There's no question about that. But I do believe, and it may well be that the two, should they find themselves continuing in office, Netanyahu and Obama, essentially find a way to cooperate. But it's not going to be easy. And I suspect if you look back, you might draw the conclusion, for example, that Anwar Sadat saved the relationship between Jimmy Carter and Menachem Begin from growing much, much worse. Now, Jimmy Carter was defeated, not because of his policies on Israel, but nonetheless, it was that common enterprise. Like Madrid saved the relationship between Yitzhak Shamir and George H.W. Bush, and the relationship between Shamir and Secretary of State James Baker. So there are bad patches with the Israelis. Common interests, common values usually succeed in creating a community of interests. And it's just this time around, you have a very long stretch in which there is little confidence, sense of giving one the benefit of the doubt on the part of these two guys. And it is occurring at a very important time in the Middle East. Arab Spring, Arab Winter, the Iranian nuclear challenge, the impasse on the Arab-Israeli peace process. There are all kinds of things that should, by definition, create a common approach between Israel and the United States, and yet certainly on the Arab-Israeli peace process, and perhaps even on Iran, if the Israelis reach the conclusion that neither sanctions nor diplomacy can work, those differences may actually grow larger.
But Aaron David Miller, you mentioned earlier the silly season is on, and undoubtedly that's the case with the elections. But when Mitt Romney's foreign policy advisor, Danson Yod, said in Israel that Romney would respect, which is an odd word, a unilateral Israeli strike on Iran. This would seem to be, first of all, I can't understand why that would even be being discussed at this point. Isn't Iran about to, it looks as though Iran's about to suffer an enormous setback with the fall of the Assads. And wouldn't this be a time to just let things happen in the Middle East and not to stir the pot?
Paradoxically, first of all, the Romney campaign, at least those who were traveling with former governor, walked that statement back and made it almost coincident with what the Obama policy was. I suspect that Dan Senior made that statement. He may have known it. He had gone too far. The press blew it out of proportion. And the campaign, or the traveling campaign, figured out that since he's abroad, Romney's abroad, he doesn't want to criticize Obama on the international stage. He certainly doesn't want to make new policy for the United States at such a sensitive moment. They walked it back. As far as the Iranians are concerned, look, I've long been a believer. This Iranian government wants a nuclear weapon. Outside of the five permanent members of the Security Council, only four other states have them: India, Pakistan, North Korea, and Israel. Iran considers itself a state that is profoundly insecure and profoundly entitled, grandiose at the same time. And I suspect the fall of the House of Assad, when it occurs, is only going to make the Iranians more determined to acquire the kind of deterrence and even offensive capacity that a nuclear weapon would give them, precisely because they're now going to feel encircled. The so-called Shia arc, Lebanon, Syria, Iran, Bahrain, I don't buy that. I think you're going to see a Sunni regime take over in Damascus at some point, and that's going to weaken Hezbollah, it's going to weaken Iran, and it's going to weaken the whole notion that the Sunni world is now being encircled itself by Shia. So that is simply going to reinforce Iran's determination
to acquire
a nuclear capacity.
But just in closing, Aaron David Miller, doesn't that sort of, in a way, justify what the former head of Mossad, Dagan, was saying, where he was saying that spurning the Saudi peace offers was a huge mistake? If you've got the Sunnis coming back, and particularly now with in Israel, the new Muslim Brotherhood president just met with the leader of Hamas. This would seem to be this is the time for the Sunni revival, right?
Yeah, but that Sunni revival is going to reinforce a consensus. Well, I mean, look, the reality is what you're going to lack in the Middle East, which is going to be very bad for Arab-Israeli peacemaking, is strong authoritative leadership willing to stand up, not only reaching out to the Israelis, but supporting the Palestinians and the kind of concessions that they're going to have to make in order to make a deal. The reality is that neither the Prime Minister of Israel nor the President of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, are prepared to pay the price that is required to reach a deal on Jerusalem, border security, refugees. Neither man is willing to take those risks right now. And frankly, the peace process is really quite separate. We cannot make the same mistake we made in Iraq, which is to assume that if you defeated Saddam, somehow the Arabs and the Israelis would be somehow more willing to make peace. It's the same with the Iranians. If somehow Iran disappeared, the challenges of Arab-Israeli peacemaking would remain as acute as ever.
Well, Aaron David Miller, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Pleasure, Ian. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Aaron David Miller, who's a public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He is on the U.S. Advisory Council of the Israeli Policy Forum and has been an advisor to six secretaries of state. Under President Clinton, he served as a deputy special Middle East coordinator for Arab-Israeli negotiations. His books include The Arab States and the Palestine Question, The PLO and the Politics of Survival, The Search for Security, Saudi Arabian Oil and American Foreign Policy, The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace, and a new book, Can America Have Another Great President? He has an article at CNN, Will Israel Trip Help Romney? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.